Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It was embarrassing. I thought that was embarrassing.
And the dogs are tied to people who are on skis.
It's graffiti, I guess, but with knit fabric.
It's easy to understand it in your head. It's a different thing to try to bring it to your dinner table and explain it to your family and go, this is something I'm really keen on.
Bringing you the best in Minnesota. Music, theater, and more. From the studios of KUOM Radio K, this is Culture Cube, the arts show that rocks. Tickets are free, and there's no wait, so take a seat and hold on to your radio.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Zach McCormick. Because Culture Q's newest czar is currently abroad, we thought to double up on hosts this week for your listening pleasure. Today, I'm joined by Mitch Skinner.
It's the first day of 2012, fall semester is over, and as hokey as it sounds, today really is the first day of the rest of your life. It's a time for new beginnings, maybe the last new beginning you'll ever get, if those doomsday theorists are to be believed. Today, our reporters will be looking at stories with themes around hitting the reset button in life. This can mean looking back at past mistakes and learning from them, or starting over with a blank slate.
For the second year in a row, Culture Q reporter Noel Clark has traveled to the East Coast with his wife for the holidays. When families come together and traditions collide, sometimes what you end up with might surprise you.
Celebrating the holidays at home in Western Massachusetts is a long-held tradition for my wife Kate's family. Every year, she and her sister Julia sat eagerly at the top of the stairs on Christmas morning while their parents, Dan and Mary Ann, set the scene.
Now can we come down?
Wait a minute, Dad's checking it out. Wait.
Dad did check it out. Now can we come down?
No. I heard him say something. Be quiet. Let's see what he has to say.
Can we come down, Daddy?
Oh, I suppose you can come down.
No.
Mom.
Wait a second. There's something moving.
Sit and stay safe.
Now, wait a minute. Oh, wow.
Mom, can we come down now? Come on.
Do you really want to come down?
Yes.
Dan was never a huge fan of being on camera or singing Christmas carols or generally drawing attention to himself. Instead, he preferred to be behind the camera, filming movies to send back home to Minnesota.
Okay, little girl.
Can you say hi to him?
Can you say hi?
Hi.
Hi who?
Hi, Daddy.
No, not hi. Look at Daddy. Not hi, Daddy. This is a movie. It's going to Minnesota. So what do you say?
Hi, Mommy and Papa.
Well, look at the camera and say that. Wave to them. Wave.
Hi.
Last Christmas, he got Mary Ann her very own camera.
That's fine.
Hello.
Hey, Mom.
They're tiny.
Mom, tell Dad how much you love your new flip phone.
I really love my new flip phone a whole lot.
He's been very excited.
It would be your flip camera.
He's been very excited.
And I really like my new flip camera a whole lot because I have wanted this for a long time because I plan to go viral.
You're not going to go viral.
I am.
Michael Scott.
What?
In January of 2011, Dan passed away. 3 years after receiving a successful double lung transplant at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, as a result of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. After the funeral, we found boxes of home movies he'd shot over the years, so I took it upon myself to digitize them for posterity.
This is good. Make sure the camera's on, Billy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, shoot.
This year, when we went back to Massachusetts, it wasn't the same. So we tried new things, like taking a trip to Boston. Even there, I continued to embarrass the family, much the same way that Dan might with his video recording. I asked people on the street about their ideas for the holidays, what their family traditions were, like this guy, who was talking to his friend about a vampire flick, and I happened to overhear.
What kind of traditions do you have in your family?
Basically just, you know, going to the house, exchanging gifts in the morning, you know, having some food and typical run-of-the-mill holiday fare, I guess you could say.
Have they changed over the years or have you done the same thing pretty much every
year?
I mean,
to a degree, you know, because obviously as you get older, you know, you're not you know, hoping to get the video game system or something like that. You know, I mean, it's more just, it turns, you know, kind of turned from something as, you know, a child where, you know, it's more about the material stuff you're going to get out of it and, you know, that. As to as an adult now, it's, you know, seeing your family and, you know, reconnecting with people and whatnot and just, you know, enjoying that vibe even for a day or whatever.
Or this busker outside of a shop.
What's your typical holiday season like?
Usually I travel to New York, see some of the family there, but a lot of it's usually, like, see me out here spending time just playing music, things like that. So, you know, my little way of, you know, I feel like I contribute a little bit to the holiday season.
So this year, I've decided that my New Year's resolution will be to keep family close and to continue the Dan Duffy tradition of embarrassing Kate and my new family-in-law with home movies in the hopes that one day, when I'm gone, they will look back on years past and smile. Thanks, Dan. For Culture Q, I'm Noel Clark.
Looking forward to the new year also requires a bit of reminiscing. While reporter Tess Weinberg spends her holiday break in Arizona, she chatted with a few Southwesterners, asking them what their favorite parts were of 2011.
Taking a trip with my wife to Europe.
The best, and that's an easy one. The best part of 2011 is my nephew and his wife had a baby boy, and he carries on the Rogan name, and because he's the only boy really left. So that was the best part.
I guess the best part of 2011 was my artistic development stage. 2011, very good stage.
Learning in school.
The best part of 2011 is that it's almost over.
And seeing my family over the holidays.
I think for me the best part was seeing our troops starting to come home from Iraq. I think I'm glad that that action is over.
Well, I think my most recent best part of 2011 would be a really fabulous trip to Europe.
The best part of 2011 for me is knowing that I have one more month of school and then I'm graduated and on to better things for the 2012.
That it was full of ones and that lots of partying but lots of arriving as well. Yeah.
The best part of 2011 for me was meeting a lot of new people and traveling abroad.
If those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it, then clearly reporter Mitch Skinner is no historian. In our next piece, he examines how sometimes a restart is simply a rehash.
Repetition surrounds me every day in my life. Whether it's repetition in my environment, like the world's most annoying cat who happens to live next door to me and likes to make its presence known at every hour in the day, or even if it's repetition that I can seemingly control. I recently started playing Pokemon again, and after a few hours of playing the game, I felt all too familiar. I picked the water-type starter, played some battles, catch some Pokemon, challenged the gym leaders, get some more Pokemon, take on the Elite Four, catch a few more Pokemon, get bored, stop playing, and start all over again when the next game comes out a few months later. So why do I keep buying the games? I want to know why I willingly hand over my money for games that change little more than the number of Pokemon you can catch.
As consumers, we face these repeated consumption episodes all the time, and I'm interested in how can we help consumers to keep enjoying these things longer.
I spoke with Joe Redden, an assistant professor of marketing at the Carlson School of Management in the University of Minnesota, about the reasons why a consumer might enjoy repeated experiences.
I can think of at least two that come up. One is if I'm learning something, I'm learning to beat a certain level in a video game, right? You know, those are the cases where we get better at the task, we enjoy that feeling of kind of flow or expertise. I wanna be the very best, like no one ever was. And so there's positive returns to that up to a point. But at some point, you know, the game does get boring. Catch 'em all, Pokemon. There's another argument too that sometimes things can be so complex that, you know, you're in a sense figuring them out. It was, you know, it's so complicated at first and so complex, it's overwhelming. With repetition, you know, we start to become familiar with it, it's easier for us, it's more natural, and that can be a positive thing as well, too.
But if I know I'm going to get bored with Pokemon, certainly an argument can be made that I can just stop playing the game altogether and try something completely new.
And, you know, certainly that's a viable option, but, you know, it's not ideal in a few ways. One, it's still not my favorite.
And of course, it's not just the consumer that wants the consumer to keep buying the same product.
As marketers, too, we would think about, we want to keep our product to be just as enjoyable as ever.
When I think of products that are continually bought and rebought, I go to the original Star Wars trilogy. The set is constantly marketed and remarketed to consumers. There's the original theatrical edition, the 1997 remastered version, the DVDs, the upcoming Blu-rays, and the eventual 3D versions. And really all that's changed is now Greedo shoots first. When talking to Professor Redden about trivial differentiation like this, he related it to me in terms of candy.
You know, M&Ms. They had people vote on the colors they wanted. You know, they're almost emphasizing that we've got these variety of colors and we're adding new colors and the new fresh version of M&Ms. I mean, they're different colors, but they're not different flavors. And so again, I think, you know, one thing firms are understanding is that just creating this mere perception of variety, that's often enough to make it not seem repetitive and not seem as boring.
As I said earlier, repetition is everywhere in my life. It plays a significant role in my Radio K work. It takes multiple recordings and re-recordings for me to finally be satisfied with the culture cue story. And as a DJ, I find that I hear and say the same words and phrases around the station when I listen long enough. Compelled by my curiosity of this seeming monotony, I sat down with John Schober, Radio K's programming director, and talked about the value repetition has for the station, such as why new songs are played so often.
We cap ourselves at 10 ads a week. That gets you about 30 spins a week on a specific artist, which is extremely important. If you're only spinning an artist like 5 times a week and you keep them in your playlist for only 5 weeks, nobody's going to hear that. That's like less than 1 time a day.
But likely even more repetitive than the music played are the drops, the short audio clips between music.
So I once heard, I think it's when I was music director, that it takes the average person 84 times to recognize a spot over the air until they fully understand what's going on.
Schober also explained to me why music breaks are pre-scheduled rather than having the DJ decide when to go on air.
Like, you can only hear so much music in a row without a break and knowing what those songs are before you kind of just tune out. So that's why we like to do it every 3 or 4 songs, so they come to know what to expect, and so it's not just crazy.
But to me, it's not the schedule of the breaks that makes for a repetitive sound, but rather the standardized approach for the layout of a break. It starts with station ID. You're listening to Radio K, Real College Radio. Then the DJ goes into their back cell.
The back cell is basically just saying what the artist in the song was.
The back cell is followed by the creamy filling.
Throw in the information about them if it's pertinent, like little trivia facts, which is the creamy filling.
Then it's the front cell.
And then you do a front cell of things to come in the hour or within the next set, just 1 or 2 things.
The DJ repeats station identification.
And then go right into the next song that you're going to play.
While I, as an involved volunteer at Radio K, notice when DJ breaks sound very similar, other listeners don't necessarily. Redden explains that consumers are less sick of or satiated with repeated experiences when they don't pay attention to the repetition.
You know, the less you're thinking about the episode, the less you're paying attention to how much you're having. You'll tend to get less satiated. And I think we see this phenomena with things like, you know, snacking while watching TV.
In other words, when no one points out the formulaic aspects of radio, listeners can enjoy what they listen to more. Whoops. Well, I think I've distracted myself long enough now. Maybe I'll pick Charmander this time. With Culture Cue, I'm Mitch Skinner.
The end of the year is often a time where we can reflect on the mistakes we've made and discover how to avoid them in the future. For our Top 7 feature this week, I'm joined by reporter Shelby Thomason to take a look back at our national regrets for 2011.
Yeah,
Starting off with this week's top seven, we really have to deal with the elephant in the room, and that's the massive unemployment figures from 2011.
It is massive. I believe it's about 8.6%. Am I right on that?
That'd be like 0.8 of a person in every 10 people that you know.
Or if you round it up, it'd be like 1 out of every 10.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit easier for everybody to understand.
Moving along to number 2 on the top 7 would be the iPhone and the death of Steve Jobs and the resulting fallout on the Mac cult of personality in this country.
Yeah, that was a real disappointment. He was really cool.
You got to find out not only who in your friend group was severely affected by the loss of Steve Jobs as a public figure, but also the people who are diehard anti-Mac people that like almost seemed happy he was dead.
Something like did come out of it that was kind of cool, and that was Siri.
Which, could you explain this a little bit better to me?
So Siri is like the person, I guess, that comes with your new iPhone 4. She'll listen to anything you have to say. She'll answer all of your questions, including not phone related issues.
Oh, so Steve Jobs sort of replaced himself with an Android.
He did.
Moving right along to the competition, a number 3 at the top 7's list of regrets, Google Plus. Not so much Google Plus as an idea, but the fact that it is
absolutely barren.
It's a ghost town on the internet.
It's sad.
You can hear the web tumbleweeds kind of rustle by.
Mm-hmm. I finally got one about 2 weeks ago. So late to jump on this bandwagon.
Unfortunately, it hasn't quite seemed to gain the cultural cachet that Facebook has yet.
But they've tried. They had a lot of advertisements this past Christmas Day.
And we'll maybe see in 2012. We remember 2011 as the year that, hey, remember when everybody was still catching on to Google Plus?
Oh, yeah.
Moving on to number 4, more internet-related issues. This is hashtag Occupy Wall Street or hashtag OWS. Now, we're not saying that we regret that there was a national movement to occupy, starting in New York City and then moving out throughout.
No, that was cool.
Yeah, I mean, large-scale protests, holding government responsible, things we are in favor of.
People being politically, active instead of apathetic.
And the national regret is more the spotty news coverage, the questionable journalistic ethics used to cover it, and the police and public relations that have kind of hit an all-time low during this whole thing.
I think all-time low might be like even gracious.
The relations in Oakland and New York City are famously bad, but over in the Twin Cities, we haven't had as much of a problem. Occupy TC actually sort of just dissipated itself after all the occupiers decided to be Minnesotan and leave early. So moving right along to number 5, this is actually a really tragic story that sort of sounds like one of those funny news stories at first. The massive private collection of animals escaping in Ohio. Can you talk a little bit more about this?
Yeah, this guy had this this big collection of exotic animals, you know, lions, tigers, bears, the typical. And after facing a lot of problems with the IRS and debt and stuff, he actually let all of them go, which is kind of funny. In response to this, about 48 of them were actually killed.
While we understand this with the large animals such as the tiger and the lion, which he names Simba.
His first exotic animal was named Simba. He bought it as a cub.
The big animals, those are a threat to public safety. We understand that. But did they really have to kill his private collection of penguins?
Yeah, that was mean.
Number 6 on this week's top 7 is the Wisconsin loss of collective bargaining rights as per an order by Governor Scott Walker. This was, again, one of those issues that was handled both poorly by the involved parties, but also by the reporting press. And some of the liberals in Wisconsin even compared themselves to the Arab Spring, I believe.
They did. They brought that on themselves. Like, they initiated that. And it was cool to see, that global community happening. But I don't know. Being under a dictatorship is not quite
the same as losing your collective bargaining rights. Close, but no cigar, Wisconsin. Number 7 on this week's top 7 list of national regrets. We're going to do a local regret here and bring ourselves back to the 20 days from July where the government shut down in Minnesota.
A complete shutdown. I think you said, what was shut down?
I was driving home from a road trip, and I couldn't pee anywhere because all of the roadside rest stops were closed, and anytime I stop in a gas station, I feel awkward if I don't buy something. Well, that does it for our national regrets of 2011. Let's hope we can do a little better on these next year.
I think we can.
I think we can, too. Here's hoping we don't have to have a national regrets of 2012.
At some point in our lives, Grandma or Grandpa hoist us up on their knee to tell the story of how the Olsons or the Johnsons or the Ericksons came to Minnesota. Reporter Yi Chin Lee shares what Grandpa Chang and Great-Grandma Wu could have told her.
University freshman Kevin Mar is the fifth generation of a Chinese immigrant family.
My great-great-grandfather was born in Taishan in China, and he came to America in 1907, and he traveled by boat. The boat ride was fairly long. It was over a month, and he first came to Seattle, and then he went to San Francisco and did a little work there. And then he eventually settled in Detroit, Michigan, where he worked in restaurants or laundromat.
Although Toh Yi didn't settle in Minnesota, he shared a common background and experiences with early Chinese immigrants in Minnesota. The first wave of Chinese arriving in Minnesota can be dated as far back as the 1870s. Most were from Guangdong in southern China, and they were largely male because of the restrictions of Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. According to Sherry Gebert Fuller, the author of the book Chinese in Minnesota, there were several reasons for early Chinese immigrants to move to Minnesota.
Minnesota had the most missionaries in China of any state during the 19th century. Then we have Minnesotans connecting with Chinese in their own country and understanding the culture. Secondly, in 1883, the Transcontinental Railroad was completed from St. Paul to the West Coast. So Minnesota at that time was already looking at potential business opportunities. And then a little later on, 1914, you have students beginning to attend the University of Minnesota.
More and more Chinese came to Minnesota, including women, in the early 20th century. Chinese families and communities started to develop. Members of the Chinese community worked hard to establish themselves as part of the overall community.
There was this constant effort to share their culture, a lot of New Year's, Chinese New Year's festivities where the general population was invited.
During World War II, China was an ally to the U.S., and Chinese immigrants were active in the war effort.
Nearly 20% of Chinese adult males enlisted. The Chinese community really wanted to show their pride and appreciation of living in the United States. And it was the first time that a lot of Chinese men worked side by side with the white community.
In 1943, Minnesota U.S. Representative Walter Judd called on Congress to appeal the Chinese Exclusion Act, and President Roosevelt signed an end to the act in the same year. It was a huge turning point because it was the first time the Chinese could become citizens of the U.S. Then the Cold War began, and Communist China became an enemy of the U.S. when it was established in 1949. Around the same time, Kevin Mar's great-uncle, Horn Yi, went back to China to get married and had a son in China. But the American government didn't allow him to bring his son over.
Horn Yi actually sued the American government, saying it's unlawful to keep him from his family, and his son was only 2 years old, so he eventually won that lawsuit, and then he brought his son over to America.
Later, Horn Yi's sister, Sandra Wong, came to Minnesota, which coincided with the greater immigration of Chinese from Hong Kong and Taiwan in the 50s and 60s. Finally, Communist China opened up in the 1970s.
The United States was suddenly very interested in learning more about China, and that was reflected in the state of Minnesota. Suddenly there were cooking classes, learn how to cook Chinese meals, learn how to use a wok. Lian Chin emerges. People become very interested in Chinese culture.
Students from China could now also come to the university to study.
My mother and her brother came to America in 1979 to attend the University of Minnesota to get an education.
Like her, many Chinese students who came to study later became professionals, were employed, and set their roots in Minnesota. The Chinese community kept growing and increasing its diversity in Minnesota.
In the 1990s, you see Minnesota has one of the highest adoption rates for children from China. A number of our governors have established significant trade missions to China. And the University of Minnesota has one of the highest populations of Chinese students in the nation. So today, it's a blending of individuals from all over the world of Chinese backgrounds. Continues to be interesting.
For Cultural Q, this is Yi Qing Li.
Well, Culture Q fans, that's our show.
This week, you heard stories from Noel Clark, Yi Qin Li, Tess Weinberg, Shelby Thomason, Zach McCormick, and me, Mitch Skinner.
Hosts for today were me, Zach McCormick, and Mitch Skinner.
Producers for Culture Q are Zach McCormick, Tess Weinberg, and Mitch Skinner.
Our Culture Q coach is Sarah Lemanchik.
Make sure to connect with us on Twitter and Facebook.
If you missed something fascinating, you can always catch recent episodes of Culture Q on RadioK.org.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.